This is episode 2 of Exploding the Canon, a new miniseries from Smarty Pants about the protests at Reed College over the mandatory freshman humanities course. If you're just tuning in, start at episode 1 to get the full story. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. On September 26, 2016, a group of Black students at Reed College staged a boycott of classes. Chanting, "Black Lives Matter, Black Reedies Matter," and accompanied by the pots, pans, and drums of a Reedy Noise Parade, students marched through campus, including, briefly, through a Hume 110 lecture, before arriving at the Quad. It was shortly after the national media reported, once again, that two Black men were killed at the hands of police, adding to an already disproportionate rate of police killings. Addison Bates was a junior at the time.
It was like Terrence Crutcher, Keith Lamont Scott, Philander Castile, and Tyree King, if I'm not mistaken. And it was like me and all the Black folks that I knew at Reed were going through so much grief. And then simultaneously, the institution itself didn't seem to be in touch or respond to the reality of the experiences of Black students at Reed.
Eden Daniel was a freshman.
This idea of a walkout was in some ways to represent like what it would be like for Black folks, yeah, just to take a break, but also just knowing like what our absence meant and what that looked like and how, you know, much work we do, how much we contribute, yet, you know, at the same time, like our lives are devalued. Like we bring so much value, but we are devalued and failed by institutions like Reed.
The students assembled on the Quad, where they'd set up speakers and microphones on a makeshift stage in front of the dining hall. They taped up photographs along the brick wall of the people who'd been killed by police in recent years. Members of the college staff and faculty joined them, and the college blog, Sallyport, estimated that some 400 people of all races participated, about a third of the student body.
We wanted to really create this space for a memorial, for grief. We had an open mic. I think that was particularly powerful. We had people come to the stage. I mean, a lot of Black faculty. I remember Derek Applewhite, who's a biology professor at Reed, come and just, it was very profound because you can kind of tell that there was a lot of these feelings that were held and shared by a lot of like Black community members at Reed.
Students highlighted that at the time, just 5% of the student body was Black. And the average rate of Black students graduating in the past 6 years was 65%, compared to 79% for all students. That number doesn't necessarily reflect the retention rate, which measures whether a first-year student returns for the fall of their second year. That was rumored to be much lower for Black students, but we don't know for sure because the school didn't, and today still doesn't, publicly break down that data by race.
Once we were digging deeper, like with the whole retention rate and all of the other ways that anti-Blackness at Reed manifested, it felt deeper than just like they didn't notice that these things were happening. It felt more like the institution itself hadn't had respect or care for Black lives.
For a lot of students who gathered that day, the event on the Quad was their first brush with political activism and with organizing any kind of large event. Addison had been in the Multicultural Resource Center with friends when news of the latest police killings gave them the idea for the walkout. In the span of just 3 days, this small group had pulled together students from every class to stage the walkout. Reflecting on the event, organizers felt like something had been awakened in them that day, a desire to change things, to make things better for Black students at Reed now and in the future. They wanted to bring their grievances to the Reed College president, John Kroger. So that same afternoon, they started writing out a list of demands.
We invited folks of color from all throughout Reed's community to come meet in the info shop and talk about our experiences of being people of color at Reed and what we felt we needed to feel safer, to feel heard, to feel more respected and cared for at Reed. And in the span of like an hour and a half, something like that, we crafted these demands with all of those other Reed community members and then presented them to John Kroger in the president's office right after that.
It felt like weeks went by, but it was like 3 days.
There were 25 demands in total, including hiring more tenure-track faculty of color, more transparency about Black retention and disciplinary rates, divestment from Wells Fargo and other corporations that profit from mass incarceration, and ongoing racial sensitivity training. But the demand that caught the most attention was number 13, for a change in the Humanities 110 curriculum. They called for a more inclusive experience for, quote, students from diverse backgrounds, including but not limited to those of different racial, gender, and socioeconomic statuses within both conference and the structural design of the course. That meant not just changing how individual conferences were led, but changing the content of the syllabus. The protesters, who had coalesced under the name Readies Against Racism, sometimes called RAR for short, framed these changes in some provocative questions challenging the current curriculum. Questions I didn't even think to ask when I was 18 and a freshman at Reed College. Partially, I'm sure, because as a white student, I hadn't had to confront them. Here are a few of those questions, printed in an October 2017 issue of the student newspaper, The Quest. How effective is Hume at engaging students with the topics it seeks to present and criticize? How can students understand Hume as being distinct from the Western canon when, for many students, this may be their first formal interaction with the Western canon? How does Hume reflect the priorities of Reed through the texts and cultures it chooses to emphasize and include in its canon? How does Hume converse with the life of the mind? For Addison, these questions about the syllabus were intimately related to their experience in the classroom.
I had like housing insecurity growing up. I did not come from wealth. And getting to Reed, I went through a lot of culture shock, is what I would call it now, in suddenly being thrust into classrooms and in the dorm and everything and this whole environment with folks who came from so much money, like money that I'd never seen before. Their parents have $70,000 extra to spend on them going to Reed every year just out of pocket. So have $250,000 to spend on their kids, sometimes multiple kids. And those are the people who I was in Hume 110 with. I felt like a fish out of water. Like I felt alienated. And I was like the only Black person in my Hume 110 class. You know, I tried to communicate these things to my professor and my professor just really shut me down and was like, basically, get over yourself. Like to put it quite clearly, I felt stupid. And I would be willing to bet that a lot of folks who don't come from those elite intellectual backgrounds, I bet you a lot of folks felt stupid in Hume 110.
And for Eden, who'd arrived on campus just a few weeks ago and had only attended a month of lectures and conferences, her participation in the protests reshaped her understanding of Hume as she was taking it.
I grew up in a predominantly Black neighborhood, underfunded high school, never had much exposure to a lot of these texts, so coming in already feeling a little out of my depth. I remember, you know, just the summer before, kind of wondering why the Iliad was the required text. I don't even think I got through the whole thing. So I came into it with some reservations, and then contextualizing it through all of what happened through September 26th, you know, the first glimpse at Hume was pretty negative.
This was not a new phenomenon at Reed. I think a lot of students, no matter their ethnic or racial background, felt it too. But nobody wanted to admit it, because Reed extolled the value of the life of the mind, of intellectualism. And frankly, because 18-year-olds are insecure about what they don't know. Aliyah Adegwemme graduated in 2006 and has served in various roles on the alumni board for years.
I did not struggle at all with feeling a sense of belonging socially most of the time. But in the classroom, I feel like, especially in Hume, where I wasn't that interested in the material and I didn't feel like it had any connection to my life, it feels like it was a kind of complicated situation with a lot of dynamics at play.
Questioning the syllabus didn't even occur to her.
You know, what's funny is that I completely internalized that distance that I was talking about. So I thought it was a problem with me, honestly. And I feel like that is really common in some ways, because Reed is an institution that kind of brands itself as being very kind of socially progressive, but at the same time has this kind of rigorous, very traditional, some might even say conservative academic structure. And I knew what I was getting into when I signed my name on the dotted line or whatever, but I didn't really with Hume 110, because it's like I knew what Greece in the fall and Rome in the spring meant, but that's very different from going through it and experiencing it. And I never thought, hey, like, this is not a flaw that I have, but it's a flaw with the institution. And that's one of the reasons why, for me, I felt so kind of intensely supportive of the RAR protests, because I thought, wow, like, these students have recognized issues with the institution while they're students and done something about it in a way that I wasn't even really able to conceptualize in my time.
We could dial the clock back even further to 1991, when Kembe's Guinea Bisiri, now professor of religion, took Hume 110 as a freshman, though he ended up transferring.
As a student, I probably didn't know enough to be able to think of it as Eurocentric. I saw it as like this canon that I should know, that I wasn't taught in high school, that, you know, I actually remember going back to my high school and writing a letter to all my humanities teachers and saying, like, you didn't train me well enough compared to like all these other students at Reed. I don't know anything. And my, you know, classmates who read half of them and things of that sort. You know, I was like trying to pronounce Thucydides, like, how do you pronounce that name? So I saw it as like the things that I should know to be able to be an active participant in a college classroom.
The question of canonicity and that of Eurocentrism are distinct. For example, Reed has a Chinese humanities curriculum centered on the Qin and Han dynasties that includes a lot of important texts like the Confucian Analects, the Tao Te Ching, etc. So the syllabus engages with a canon, but it is not Eurocentric. Eurocentrism literally means centering attention on Europe, but practically it means interpreting the world through the lens of Western values, which goes beyond Europe to encompass places like North America and Australia. We're going to untangle the mess of the West more thoroughly in a later episode, but for now, it means looking at all cultures, whether European or not, through a European lens. From a teaching perspective, that can mean professors of European history or literature aren't asked to stretch outside of their comfort zones to discuss other modes of thought. But professors who specialize in Islam, for example, are. Kembe's returned to Reed as a professor in 2002.
The time that it really clicked for me how Eurocentric was during my interview. The person before me who had interviewed had apparently refused to teach in Hume 110 for whatever reason, because I got this cryptic email from one of the search committee members that said something about, like, does this candidate know that part of this position requires teaching in Hume 110? And so when I got there, like, that was one of those things to make sure, like, I knew that that was part of it. And I, at that moment, I realized, like, oh man, I learned like all of these things in Islamic studies, and I haven't dealt with any of these sources for a very long time. And if I dealt with like Greek sources, it was in the way in which they have come into the Islamic tradition. Now, like 60% of my teaching is not going to have anything to do with the stuff I actually have been spending all this time, like the difficult Arabic texts I've been trying to read and do all those things. And then my colleagues who are working on Europe, actually, their research and what they've trained in builds nicely with what the Hume 110 class offers. A lot of my training was not going to be relevant.
Another way of thinking about how Eurocentrism might appear in Hume 110 would be to consider how it introduces the disciplines taught at a college like Reed. I asked Peter Steinberger, professor of political science and humanities, why he thought Hume was important.
What I've always found really useful about Hume 110 is that in many cases we are teaching students, introducing them to the disciplines by having them read what you might call the emergence or the foundational or the original works of the discipline. And that's controversial, but my view is really, you know, philosophy in a certain sense, as we understand philosophy as a matter of contextual analysis, you really can't find many examples of it before Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. In terms of serious historiographical work, self-critical, so-called scientific history. You know, there's a lot of history in the Bible and all that kind of thing, but you don't find that kind of self-critical disciplined history before Herodotus and Thucydides. And that to me makes the ancient Mediterranean world particularly interesting and particularly useful.
As Peter says himself, this is a controversial take and not universal in academia by any stretch. But Peter has been teaching in the course for decades, and today is the longest-serving faculty member in humanities. And his perspective and experience at the college carries a lot of weight, even if his colleagues don't necessarily share his opinion on this. Jan Mieszkowski started teaching German and humanities at Reed in 1997.
Look, someone like Peter will say in so many words, he thinks the Greeks invented thought. And, you know, you have to study Plato and Aristotle or you don't see the invention of thought. Now, in contemporary academia or whatever, that idea is heretical in the extreme. But, you know, he doesn't mean that in a bad way. He just thinks you can put a finger on where it happened.
Even if you don't share Peter's perspective on the disciplines, though, you might agree that the liberal arts curriculum is in some fundamental way the European liberal arts curriculum, because that's where our model for the liberal arts comes from.
Now, of course, this is a course in Western humanities. So we're not doing East Asian materials. We're not doing South Asian materials. We're not doing South American materials. We're not doing Sub-Saharan African. So, you know, there are limitations to what we can do. On the other hand, those materials from the ancient Mediterranean that we're talking about, those materials have formed the basis of the liberal arts curriculum, for better or worse. And if you don't like the liberal arts curriculum, that's fine. Okay? But in order to criticize it, you really kind of understand what's going on first before you begin to seek to undermine it.
That is certainly what my opinion about Greece and Rome was going in. Yes, let's critique the canon, but let's read it first. An anti-colonialist play like Aimé Césaire's Une Tempête doesn't hit quite as hard if you haven't read The Tempest. As my fellow alum, Michelle Nyehouse, wrote in The Atlantic, what I learned in Hume 110 is that so-called Western civilization is a narrative, much like any other, except that it happens to affect just about everyone on Earth. No matter where we were born or what we look like or what we believe, the narrative of Western civilization is part of the cultural water we swim in. By taking me back to the origins of that narrative, Hume 110 did me the great favor of hauling it into view and impressing me with the universal right and duty to question it. But part of what Reedies Against Racism was asking was how much of a challenge Hume 110 actually presented to the canon, and how well it actually trained people to read difficult texts, especially people who'd never encountered ancient sources before.
When I, as a first year student, read Aristotle, I didn't understand the word I was reading. I remember actually going to my conference leader and saying, like, I don't know what I'm reading. Like, I don't understand it. Like, should I keep reading? And he was like, you know, don't worry, it's difficult. And like, just listen to the lectures. But teaching Islam, I'd read, I would always encounter this too. And it would make me very upset because people would come to me and be all like, well, we didn't know what to do with this primary source you gave us because we don't have enough background. I'm like, really? Like, who gave you background on Plato? Like, you take the text seriously and you try to figure out what it's saying. But like, the assumption is that Plato is speaking to you while the Quran is not.
Right? So on September 28th, just 2 days after the walkout, students began sitting in the Humanities 110 lecture well in front of 300 freshmen. Pancho Savory, professor of English and humanities, was one of the minority of faculty members who were openly supportive of the students from the beginning.
What they did was to come into the lecture hall and sit down surrounding the podium. They were not disruptive in any way. They didn't make any noise. Some of them held signs, but they were completely respectful of the person who was giving the lecture. Nevertheless, some faculty members were very upset. Some faculty members refused to give their lectures because they felt they were being harassed by students. There was very little public support for the students from the faculty.
But some faculty had reservations.
I would have been totally comfortable joining their protests if they weren't actually taking over Ballin Hall. taking over Ballin Hall meant that faculty members don't have the freedom to be able to say what they want to say in the terms that they would want it to say. It became a space of protest. And like, I'm particularly sensitive to that as a person who teaches Islam. Is someone going to like hold a sign behind me that says Islam is misogynist when I'm teaching about Islam or something of that sort? Like, you know, I can't have that. I felt like institutionally we shouldn't allow for it. But the concerns that were raised were very real concerns that we should, like, frankly, as faculty, we should have dealt with a long time ago. And they were, students were asking people like me about, like, why haven't you guys done this before? They were like, well, we tried. We just got to vote it down. And we were sort of waiting for our turn.
On October 6th, there was an open meeting in the student union with students, Readies Against Racism organizers, and the Hume faculty. The student newspaper, The Quest, published two articles about it, including one that asked, what does it say about our school when the definition of institutional racism has to be explained to a room full of PhD holders? Student Urell Watson was quoted as saying, this isn't a new issue that popped up out of nowhere. There's been Black students and women students at Reed who've reacted to this long ago. At the meeting, a committee of 6 students and 6 faculty was created to discuss reforming Hume 110. Mary James, who at the time was professor of physics and the dean of institutional diversity, helped set it up.
So I'm a faculty member, and I completely understand to have someone very publicly say that you're failing them. Like, their faculty at Reed, being a good teacher is part of their identity. It's not this thing they do on the side. It's not, you know, it's really part of their identity. And so to have folks publicly proclaim that you're failing them at this most essential thing that you think of yourself professionally, that's a hard hit. That's a really hard hit. And trying to help the faculty hear the essence as opposed to kind of the rancor was a goal.
Natalia King, professor of English and Humanities, wasn't on that committee, but she, like most of the faculty, was starting to think deeply about Hume 110.
Two of my students from my prior Humanities conference were really active in the Black Lives Matter movement, and I had lots and lots of conversations with them about what they were doing and why they were doing it and how effective it was. But I think one of the things that became really evident to me is that at that point in time, you know, during that year of protest, was that in some fundamental way, the course was failing or not reaching a very important cohort of students. And it seemed to me that it had to be possible to create a course that had the capacity, that had the cultural amplitude to reach everyone.
At the monthly faculty meeting a week later, on October 10th, students observed a heated debate among faculty about whether to characterize the protests as respectful. This was one of the first indications, to students and onlookers at least, that a divide among the faculty over the stakes of the protests was widening.
I remember a colleague, you know, who's this incredibly popular teacher, coming to my office one day and saying, like, this student hates me! You know, and it was for some ostensibly political reason or something. And they were so shocked, because it never happened before. How could this be? What was really interesting was to realize, like, how many of my colleagues were really, really not used to being criticized, and particularly by the students. And again, not to be like holier than whatever, like, I mean, no one likes being criticized, no one likes not being liked, you know, one like, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the simple fact they were being criticized was you know, the clapback, to use the expression, was strong. And it was like, well, you know, hold on here, you know, it's okay. You know, like one has to have a certain kind of humility.
To quote Anne Delahanty, professor of French and Humanities, the events of the past few weeks have provided ample evidence that we don't know how to talk about race at Reed College.
Americans can't talk about race. And so why we would expect the Reed faculty in particular to be able to talk about race, that for me, that was not an expectation. And this was a call to say, we can't educate Americans and not talk about race, you know, particularly in a foundational course in America. And particularly at a predominantly white institution. So now you've got a white faculty member, well, let's say 14 white kids, one Hispanic and one African-American in your Hume section. And now you're going to talk about race. So even if you've decided, yes, I'm going to take on this challenge, it's huge. Right from the start, I was thinking, well, the Hume faculty could do this, but if the pedagogy doesn't change, this whole thing's not going to work.
On October 26th, after a month of three times a week sit-ins, the faculty voted to accelerate the timeline of the regular Hume 110 curriculum review by 1 year. On November 7th, Mike Brody, the vice president for student services, delivered a November progress report on the demands that RAR had delivered to President Kroger, followed by another a month later. That progress included a standing committee on student success, more transparency about demographics and graduation rates and disciplinary enforcement practices, prioritizing on-campus housing for students with financial hardship, and the drafting of an anti-racism statement to bolster the existing one on diversity. Plus, two more student interns were hired in the Multicultural Resource Center to focus on racial justice and first-generation college students. And more were in the works for peer mentorship and the Office for Inclusive Community.
And then Trump was elected. And everything changed. The students were so freaked out. They were 10 years old when Obama was elected. That was their idea of a president. And the fact that this country could elect Donald Trump, I mean, the level on which they just tossed their world into the dryer and tumbled it around just cannot be overestimated. And then everybody was the enemy. They would talk to me, but everything changed. Everything.
On November 12th, horrific graffiti was found on the Reed Library walls.
Reed College administrators say they were taken aback after hateful messages were discovered scrawled in black on the library wall, including "The white man is back in power," "swastikas," "the N-word."
Mike Brody and Mary James spoke to KOIN News about the incident.
Some students have reported to us that they feel unsafe.
I was heartsick. And it was very clear that we needed to respond immediately.
The perpetrators were never caught. On November 14th, hundreds of students, faculty, staff, and alumni rallied in the library lobby to counter the graffiti, which had been swiftly erased by maintenance workers, with messages of love and support. That same day, Readies Against Racism escalated and took over the admission office to demand more of President Kroger, including, among other things, a school-wide assembly to discuss how the administration was addressing racism at Reed, declaration of Reed as a sanctuary college on top of Portland's existing sanctuary city status, academic accommodations for work disrupted by national events and local protests. Students occupied the office for the entire week, around the clock, until on November 18th, President Kroger declared Reed College to be a sanctuary college, too. And still, this whole time, students were sitting at the front of the Volham Lecture Hall every morning at 9 a.m. to demand changes from Humanities 110.
It was a really scary time. Like, I remember some white supremacist group drove around Elliott Circle to, like, intimidate us with their, like, flag flying in their truck, and one of our Google Docs, like a sign-up sheet for some type of petition, it got infiltrated by white supremacists and they were like putting slurs on it. Someone got like hate mail in their Reed mailbox.
I was frustrated how a lot of the work we were doing, especially on Hume, like was reduced to sort of privileged liberal arts students, like these woke kids are just complaining about some books they have to read and not really understanding, the stakes kind of felt high, and not necessarily just about Hume, but like all of the things that were going on. So it was a chance for us to like advocate for ourselves, and that looked like getting more of an equitable like syllabi, whatever that looked like. You know, I didn't expect to be made visible through the Hume syllabus at all. But I did feel like, wow, wouldn't it be nice to be able to engage with texts that were always just told to me as what I should know as like the foundation for intellectual thought.
This was not a new feeling for Black students at Reed College. In fact, nearly 50 years before Eden set foot on campus, the Black Student Union had come together around that same sense of dissatisfaction with the syllabus. And on that day in November, Readies Against Racism was taking a page out of their book. Because in 1968, the Black Student Union of Reed College had occupied Elliott Hall to demand a Black Studies program, and won. But just 7 years later, the program would be dissolved.
They just put something in place, a Band-Aid, until us students that were involved, we kind of left. They didn't really truly care.
This episode was produced by me, Stephanie Bastek, with original music by Ray Royal, audio storytelling consulting by Mickey Kapper. Thank you to Nigel Nicholson, Jan Miskowski, Peter Steinberger, Natalia King, Combi's Gania Basari, Poncho Savory, and Libby Drum for taking the time to speak with me about events that still feel raw on campus. This series, like all of Smarty Pants, is sponsored by the Phi Beta Kappa Society and published under the umbrella of the American Scholar magazine. Thank you for listening.